Stand by.
Blog Talk Radio. It's 4 o'clock.
We'd like to welcome everybody today to On Point with your host, Don Allen, and that's me and Mr. Ron Edwards. It's currently 23 degrees outside. Mr. Edwards, how you doing?
Fine, Mr. Allen. You're right. It is a gray, overcast day here in the Twin Cities. We're coming to you from our studios. By the way, border battle, everybody's all pumped up with their purple or their green and gold. We'll talk about that during the sports portion of On Point. But understand we have a contributing guest with us again, and why don't we introduce him, and let's move into the subject matter.
Yes, On Point is pleased to have Minneapolis celebrated civil rights attorney, Mr. Michael Patton, on the air with us to go over some details and some information on some of the high-profile cases he's working on here in the Twin Cities. Mr. Patton, welcome.
Thanks a lot for having me, Mr. Allen and Mr. Edwards. I appreciate it. I really enjoy being on your show. Thank you.
All right. Jason Anderson, he seems to stay in courtrooms, if you will. allegedly is looking at a second termination. His attorneys and the president of the Police Federation, my friend John DeMonico, indicated they have get this behind him and get him back on the streets. That'll be a real disaster. But anyways, Mr. Patton, I know that you had observers at trial. Give us, if you would, some of your thinking and reflections on this latest Houdini escape act by our good friend Jason Anderson.
Well, I have to be honest with you. I was not surprised. I mean, I'm probably the most cynical person to talk to about this because, you know, I represented a family. I was lead trial counsel in what was arguably the most egregious homicide in the history of the Minneapolis Police Department. Of course, I speak of the Fong Lee case. Certainly, there have been many others, and I don't mean to denigrate those. But, I mean, when you have a citizen shot 8 times who didn't have a weapon, which was revealed clearly on an elementary school camera, and then you have a gun found near his body, which clearly had to have been a drop gun due to the lack of trace evidence on the gun, it's when you have a case where allegedly the victim was a person of color, and my understanding from speaking with the observer I had at the trial and also speaking with the media about this, this young man didn't testify, but it did go into evidence that he was African American, and it did go into evidence that the person that he was with was wearing a belt buckle, which indicated gang membership, so it's not real difficult to connect the dots there. The jury presumably would have had the belief that this young man was a gang member, and they knew he was a person of color. The jury, like the Fong Lee case, was all Caucasian. There was one woman on the jury who was Asian, but she was an alternate, so she would not have participated in the verdict. Mm-hmm. So you have a white cop, you have an African-American young man who allegedly, and I say allegedly, I don't know this for a fact, but I think it was alleged that he had resisted arrest. And then you have an all-white jury from primarily rural Minnesota. I can't say I was surprised at all by the verdict, sadly.
I was not either. And just for, again, our listening audience, both domestically and particularly internationally, in the United States, a jury that is drawn in a federal case in a jurisdiction is drawn from that entire jurisdiction. And in the case of federal cases in Minnesota, Minnesota is a federal district in and of itself, and so consequently citizens throughout the state of Minnesota would be called for federal jury duty. And what Mr. Patton is sharing with us is something he and I and some others who have been both trial watchers and practitioners and et cetera have known, is that you get folks from as far up as International Falls and as far south as Marshall and Winona and the Cook, Minnesota, and et cetera. So you have folk that really have no relationship to the urban experience, if you will, and so that's what Mr. Patton is talking about.
And Mr. Edwards, I would note as an aside that in my case, the Fong Lee case, I lived in Minnesota. I wasn't born and raised here, but I've lived in this state for 27 years, and I've tried cases all over the state, so I'm very knowledgeable of outstate Minnesota. We had people on our jury in the Fong Lee case who were from communities I had never heard of. I mean, names of cities I had never heard of. And along those same lines, and I think you'll find this interesting, during the voir dire process, where jurors are asked whether they know any of the involved litigants, that type of thing, the panel as a whole was asked, do any of you know Jason Anderson or know of him? Not one person raised their hand.
Right, right, right.
I mean, you'd have to be living under a rock to not know who this guy is.
Absolutely.
And I, you know, it's interesting, and this is consistent with, I'm involved in another high-profile case concerning a an officer who committed suicide in early June, do we know? And in this particular case, I allege that he engaged in just ridiculous excessive force with a young woman who he tackled, caused a comminuted fracture of her wrist. We had a jury trial of that case at the end of September. It was supposed to go to trial in early June, but on the same day that the trial was to start on this ridiculous disorderly conduct charge, the same day the case was set to start, at the noon recess, he committed suicide.
Yes, I remember
now,
that. Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, to say that the trial has nothing to do with the timing of his suicide, I think is a little disingenuous, but what happened in that case, the case we tried at the end of September, the judge was Mel Dickstein, a very distinguished judge in Hennepin County, and we talked about how we were going to handle voir dire because, you know, I was like, Judge, look, I mean, I'm concerned that people may, there might be a sympathy factor, and I think we need to delve into whether any potential juror might know about this case and might feel sympathetic and therefore, you know, be a problem for my client. He said, Mike, I said, I bet you that no one will know who the guy is. Sure enough, when we did the jury selection, we asked, the name Dewey Know was asked, not one person in this Hennepin County jury raised their hand as to. Now, they may have known of the circumstance, and maybe they didn't connect the name with, you know, I mean, you know, he was arguably the highest profile cop in department history because of his, you know, his being shot to pieces in his settlement and whatnot.
And being paid over $4 million as a settlement. Right, right.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's strange. It's interesting. I certainly agree with the contention that the memory of people is like breath on a mirror. It's amazing how people just forget, you know. And, you know, maybe that was a factor. But in any event, the outcome of the Anderson, the most recent Anderson trial, really did not surprise me at all.
As a layperson, Mr. Patton and Mr. Allen, you know, my take was, I mean, first of all, you're absolutely correct. I knew that the case had been lost when the previous day or the day that the jury went into deliberations, the Star Tribune, Hershielos, reported that on the stand, a contritioned Jason Anderson said, yes, you know, I kicked him. I was merely kicking him to force him to comply. To get him to move his arms out. We're taught that in Minneapolis. My foot may have come up off his shoulder and hit him and kicked him in the back of the head. I knew what that meant because the mindset of the jurors that were sitting on that case tells me as an African-American that their support and sympathy towards Jason was what you had said earlier, that there were certainly the allegations that young Mr. Johnson, who was the party that was assaulted by Anderson, could possibly have been a gang member, though I don't know how you reach a determination about gang affiliations based on a buckle. I noticed no one has ever shown that buckle, and no one has really ever described that buckle. I don't know if the buckle says I'm a gangbanger or whatever. But at the point that the statement was made and Jason, you know, did his penance, he prostrated himself, and took, quote-unquote, his two licks or whatever, I knew what had happened. And the jury's contention had to be for, what was it, Mike, an hour and a half they delivered? Well, said, well, you know, he didn't kill the kid. He didn't blow his brains out, so, you know, there's nothing here. And I think it's just a sad commentary on the quest for justice in Minnesota.
Yeah,
Mike, where do you
bottom,
think Jason goes from here?
I personally think the city of Minneapolis is still going to fight his reinstatement. Because they can, even though he's been exonerated by a jury in federal court, they still can stand by their discharge based on, I believe their allegation was that he was dishonest in the internal affairs investigation. So they have their separate investigation. I think legally they can keep him on the force. Now, whether that will happen or not, I don't know. But, you know, it's really interesting to know, and I've noted this in previous interviews with you gentlemen, that ever since the Fong Lee trial, The city and the department have done everything humanly possible to keep this guy off the department. Doesn't that tell you something? They've done everything humanly possible to keep this guy off the department. Now, at the time of the trial, they were treating him like he was the greatest human being ever born, and he actually was awarded a Medal of Valor for gunning down a kid eight shots, who was running away from him, running for his life.
Right.
And the chief of police of Minneapolis gives him a Medal of Valor. I mean, that's just outrageous.
Yes.
Mike, you have another case which is pretty high profile, and of course the media hasn't been touching it. Could you just share that with us a little bit? An African American,
plummeted and beaten by the police. Yeah, thank you. The case is Iris Stafford, and actually Channel 9 did a real nice job of covering the case for the local Fox affiliate. This man was driving in North Minneapolis with two African-American companions. He was pulled over on a street. This was at 4 in the morning. And all the evidence, this is all depicted on squad video. Squad video shows an officer walking up to the side of his car, and it was a pickup truck that this man was operating. Now, he was allegedly pulled over for having a right rear brake light that didn't work. So it was a mechanical issue. It's a common thing. You walk up and you say, hey, what's the story? And you give a person a ticket. Or typically with mechanical issues, you get a warning. Well, this officer for the Minneapolis Police Department, I guess, had something else in mind, because what he did was he took him out of his vehicle, immediately threw him against the side of the pickup, then he threw him down on the ground, and he was beaten up. And there were at least six, maybe more, squad cars that showed up, and just you see officers just jumping around all over the place. You do see one officer actually pull a taser out of his, and the reason you know it's a taser movement is because typically people are right-handed, and the way that officers wear these things, they have their holstered gun on the right side, and then the taser is on the left side. So if you see an officer reach over to the left side and pull something out, you can reasonably conclude that's a taser. My client says he was tased, although the department is adamant that he was not tased, although the taser certainly was out. I mean, you can see that. If anybody doesn't agree with my description of what I'm saying here, feel free to email me at mike.padden@paddenlaw.com. I will send you the video. Everything I'm telling you is depicted on the video. If that's not bad enough, that they beat the you-know-what out of this guy for doing absolutely nothing wrong other than allegedly having a mechanical issue. He's not resisting at all, by the way. As the video goes on, and I retained an expert, a guy who's been in the auto body mechanical business for 50 years, although you really wouldn't need an expert for this, but just to make it clear. After this happens and he's taken away, the video is still on the squad video, and a tow truck guy shows up. He then takes the vehicle and drives it up onto a flatbed tow truck. You can see both rear brake lights, gentlemen, and both rear brake lights are working perfectly fine. In other words, the officer flat out lied for the probable cause to allegedly pull this citizen over.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Now, by the way, there were also two other African-Americans in the truck with him who were, in fact, also plummeted. In fact, the video will show them at one point being forced to kneel, which scared, you know, the stuffings out of them. But, you know, Mike, just wanted to remind you, we, on our television program, Black Focus on MTN last year, showed that video in its entirety. And we there was a lot of calls that we received, and in fact, we showed it two consecutive weeks. In fact, one of the things that amazed me about that, and me and Mr. Allen have talked about it frequently, is that while Ira was in the back seat, he was being beaten to the tune of Willie Nelson.
He's first pulled over, you can hear a country tune blaring. It's pretty hilarious.
And you can also hear the country tune when they were whipping him in the back seat. I mean, we talked about that. But go ahead.
Yeah, but the point about something like that is this was all obtained on a squad video, and the only reason that my client obtained the video from his criminal defense attorney was he was prosecuted for this ridiculous circumstance. To the credit of the prosecutor, his name escapes me, but he was a prosecutor, I believe, with the city attorney's office. When he saw the video, this prosecutor was so outraged that he immediately dropped the charges. My client was never convicted. He was never convicted because the prosecutor, and this guy's a decent guy. Not all prosecutors are bad people.
Mm-hmm.
He saw it, and he was sour raised. He immediately dismissed the case. So my client was never convicted of anything having to do with that circumstance. But the point is, if that kind of thing happens, okay, in the absence of the squad video that shows all this, my client wouldn't have a case. You know why? Because nobody would believe him. Now, I believe
Absolutely.
People. But if it's his word against 10 police officers, who do you think the jury's going to believe?
Yeah,
so,
absolutely.
So the issue becomes, how often do things happen against people of color in the city of Minneapolis where it's not depicted by their own video? I mean, this could have happened outside of the range of the video.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, how often are people's civil rights violated where the evidence isn't secure, where you don't have the smoking gun evidence? I mean, if you take the Jason Anderson case, for example,
mm-hmm.
If it wasn't for that, the luck of that elementary school camera panning at the time it panned, it could have easily been panning away and caught nothing substantive about the foot chase.
Mm-hmm.
But that camera tells you so much about what that case is about because the kid doesn't have any weapon.
Absolutely.
You juxtapose that with the fact that a gun ends up near his body afterwards and has no trace evidence on it. How can you have a human being shot 8 times with blood spurting everywhere, and the gun that's found near his body doesn't have one speck of blood, no fingerprint, not even a smudge mark?
Yeah. Well, but we all know, unfortunately, what the Eighth Circuit said.
Right.
Yeah. Though the Eighth Circuit made reference to some portion of the video, which I don't know when they saw it, but, you know, that's an issue for somebody other than you, if you know what I mean.
But it's interesting to point out, Mr. Edwards and Mr. Allen, since the Fong Lee case, which I think has taken the veil off this department, I'm very proud of our work on that case, even though the result. Now, there is an appeal pending. We are seeking to have a writ of certiorari. We filed a writ of certiorari with the United States Supreme Court, and hopefully they'll review. But the point is, it's interesting to see how the city has handled. I mean, they've settled many cases of excessive force since then for good money.
Including Dominic Felder for $1.8 million. Well, the jury found it. Yeah, $1.8 million. Mm-hmm.
Well, but the point is, and there was that other gentleman that was depicted, whose name escapes me, who was beat up in the vehicle, getting out
Jenkins.
Of the vehicle. It was, yeah.
Jenkins.
So,
as Jenkins.
And there have been others. There certainly have been many others.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a positive sign.
Okay. Mr. Allen, you got anything?
Well, I like to back up with what you were talking about, Mr. Edwards, on Black Focus when you showed that video. I remember that whole week in the turn of events because WCCO, the CBS affiliate, Channel 4, played a sanitized, whitewashed version of that video on a news report to point out.
Caroline Lowe.
Mm-hmm. Played a sanitized video to show that, you know, kind of point that maybe Mr. Stafford, you know, was up to no good that night or whatever. But when you look closely at the video that you played on Black Focus, there it was. You know, the up on the tow bed of the tow truck, both lights were on. And it was just incredible because we questioned them about it. And I actually have a caller calling in that might have a question regarding this.
Go right ahead. Let's get them on. We have
live
Mr.
On the point. Who am I speaking with? Hello? Okay, let's try that again. You're live on the air on point. Who am I speaking with?
Hi, my name is Lisa Delgado. How are you doing?
Hey, I'm doing great, Lisa. How are you?
I have several questions when it comes to officers testifying or they're giving statements that are sworn statements and then they're used to take out warrants of arrest or they're used to as affidavits and charging documents. When it's proven those officers have lied, what is the city doing to terminate those officers? Because truly, they can't be trusted ever again to arrest somebody, to write a statement, nor can their testimony hold up in court. And how many attorneys have gone back and appealed based on those officers later being found out to be liars?
Mr. Patton?
I think out of deference, Mr. Patton,
yeah.
And I have a historical piece that I can indicate to the caller. Mr.
Patton? Well, it's a good question, and the answer is, as far as I'm concerned, in terms of internal affairs, if an officer lies under oath under any circumstance, whether it's an affidavit in support of a search warrant, whether it's testimony before a grand jury, whether it's, you know, whether it's giving a statement to internal affairs, whether it's any under oath situation, and they're proven to have been dishonest, as far as I'm concerned, they should be immediately terminated, period.
But the city of Minneapolis isn't doing that.
I hear you.
Well,
I hear you.
They have in the case of a couple, and one of the highest profiles was in the case of at that time Sergeant Don Banham, who later became an inspector and then was demoted. Don Banham was involved in an incident at a Vikings game. Refresh people's memory. At a Viking game, an altercation between he and a photographer, not to be confused with the infamous Dennis Rodman situation at the Target Center. Don
right.
Banham was charged with providing false statements and actually went on trial, but luckily was acquitted. The other one is, of course, Jason Anderson, who we've been talking about earlier, who the city has terminated because they maintained during his interview with the Civilian Review Authority that it was determined that he lied as it pertains to the incident he was just acquitted on in federal court. And the city has indicated that they have terminated him for being, you know, not being honest. But it's very rare. I can think of 12 or 13 cases I know I've been involved in as an advocate, and the officers clearly lied. It was determined during the course of the proceedings that they lied. Nothing happens.
I mean,
and also, Mr. Edwards, if you look at the Ira Stafford case, this officer that prepared the report and says for the reason that Ira was pulled over in terms of probable cause that his right rear brake light wasn't working, you can see right in the video that's a bald-faced lie. So,
absolutely.
What are they going to do about this guy? I don't know if there's been an internal affairs investigation, but how can you keep somebody like that on the force with that when his own squad video shows that he was dishonest?
Well, I have to tell you that that's one of the issues, though, that caused them to lose the Dominic Felder case, and that was a report that was changed and altered 3 days after the initial incident by a female officer who arrived. But in the case of those two officers, there has never been any charges filed by the department against them for perjury or acting in less than an honest manner, et cetera. In fact, there was one other officer that came pretty close. Sergeant Charlie Adams came pretty close to being indicted for false information in a situation in which a white officer was ultimately charged and discharged from the department, and this officer is involved in the very high-profile Courtney Williams murder.
Another case, too, not to belabor the point, but I was involved in the Eddie Griffin case where two officers arrived at the scene. Young Eddie showed obvious signs of intoxication. They did absolutely no field sobriety tests. He was heard to offer a bribe to these officers. Not only did they not do field sobriety tests or take him into custody, they drove him home. They went outside of their jurisdiction and drove this pro basketball player home. And they didn't have permission to do that. Those two officers were never disciplined.
Absolutely.
I'm looking at a statement that came off of NPR radio, and they talk about Officer Lucas Patterson and another officer swearing out a statement. And these are, once again, this is a couple that was stopped. And the statement goes on to say that this woman, Ms. Nancy Johnson, jumped on his partner's back, and that was why they used mace on her and stuff. And it was all being taped, and it was found that not only did she step out of the car, but they told her to get back, and she got back. And on their video, she never approached them, but yet she was charged. And once again, the Hennepin County Attorney's Office gets the video and dismisses all charges, but those officers are still on the street.
Yeah, well, what was interesting about that case, Ms. Delgado, was that actually there was a second set of video. What really exonerated her is that there was a street video which clearly showed her complying with the officers. That, unfortunately, did not come in, and I say unfortunately for what she and her significant other had to go through, but it became quite an embarrassment for the city because in that particular case, the city thought that video had been destroyed, and they did not realize that the person who was in charge of maintenance had kept that video, and some way or another, it got turned over to the attorneys for the couple that you've just mentioned. And if I'm not mistaken, the city sailed on that one, too, didn't they, Mr. Patton?
I think so.
I believe they did. I'm looking at the article that says they settled, but once again, you have two officers that are writing the statement. One knows what his partner wrote that was used to charge this woman, and they both let it go through the legal process that charges were filed on her. Once again, those are two more lying police officers that are going to be in charge of pulling you over, Mr. Edwards, pulling you over, Mr. Allen. Unfortunately, when I come in town in Minnesota, they pull me over, and they can say whatever they want without any
recriminations or anything. Yeah, right, Jay. You're absolutely correct. I mean, we've cited on this program right now in the last 8 or 9 minutes a number of cases. Normally what the chief and the department will tell you is that no one filed a formal official complaint yet when they were charging all those black officers a couple of years ago for a multiplicity of actions. They went after Bannum, poor Lee Edwards, Charlie Adams, even in the case of Charlie Adams' brother. And then the job they did on Mike Roberts, who had to serve a year in the federal penitentiary, it shows you that when they want to, they can do something about it. When they don't want to, nothing happens.
Well, what is the community going to do to demand that these officers be removed from the department for lying under the oath?
You know, that's a good question. That's a question that needs to be posed to the community and its leadership, because they've had every opportunity to do something about it. So, you know, they'll have to make up their mind, but people like yourself and others will have to ask them that question. What do they intend to do?
All right.
All right, then. Thank you.
Hey, thank you, Lisa.
And, Mr. Patton, we want to thank you. That was an interesting question, and we appreciate that call, because there again, it opened the big book that apparently that we all have that we can just make. I mean, you know, Mike, when you think in terms of a call like that, the immediate response that we had with respect to historical situations, if I were citizens in this metropolis, I'd be a little concerned. You know, it's not like we had to stumble and put our hand to our forehead. I mean, it flows off, and to me, that's dangerous. These incidents, if you will, just incident after incident after incident after incident.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, all right then.
All right. Mr. Patton, anything else? Okay.
Oh, we might have lost Mike, too. He might have cut out when Delgado came on. Interesting question by the previous caller. We hope that maybe a couple others will certainly take the opportunity to call in. You know, she asked a real tough question.
Mr. Patton?
Yeah, I lost you guys for a second.
Sorry.
Okay.
Mr. Edwards, I just wanted to, before we let finish up here with Mr. Patton, I just want to say, you know, we have the Civil Rights Department in Minneapolis, and it seems... The Minneapolis Department of Civil Rights under the leadership of Velma Corbell and Michael Kip Brown in downtown Minneapolis. And it seems to me that there should be some kind of, you know, the woman just, Lisa just asked the question about, you know, what is the community? How is the community going to address this? Well, we haven't heard an outcry about anything. I mean, from 2009 when Mayor R.T. Ryback says, I'm going to cut the funding to cultural events, specifically black cultural events, we didn't hear a peep out of clergy, business leaders, no one, flagship organizations. And in this case, we have the Iris Stafford case. We have a couple other high-profile cases, and still these people remain mute.
Well, I think Mr. Patton can really help you on something like that, and that is we – I had a couple of private conversations during the Fong Lee case, in which the Asian / Hmong community, but the overall Asian community was there in significant force. We attempted to get African American leadership interested in also coming, with the exception of a couple people who are, you know, kind of traditional activists. Not a single African American clergy or African American civil rights organizations and et cetera actually spoke out. Though the Asian community did invite those of us who they knew were there with them from the get-go. The problem is that in the African-American community, your community cannot speak out on these kinds of issues. They are too tied to the purse strings of the Democratic Party. They're too tied to other kinds of circumstances, if you will, in which the man's got information on them. And so they don't do anything. But I'd like to hear from one of those who are a supporter of the quote-unquote leadership to explain to us the question that she just asked and you just asked. At what point does the leadership of a community get involved with an important issue?
Yeah, I talked to a just to interject here actually real quick. I talked to a couple of community stakeholders. These are older gentlemen that I respect as, you know, they give me a lot of advice, and you know, one of them called me up one day because in one of my blog posts I put, you know, the community leaders, and he called me up and says, hey, don't call them criminals leaders. And I said, what are you talking about? He says, until they get to the point where they address things like Mr. Patton's been talking about, like you've been talking about,
still here.
And so until they get to that point where they start, you know, addressing those things, you know, like you said, Mr. Edwards, they're in the pockets of the city coffers.
That's right. Mr. Patton, now, before we let you go, anything that you want to bring forward that we haven't touched on?
No, other than, you know, you raised the Civil Rights Department. I can tell you the Civil Rights Department, as it pertained to the Fong Lee family, was next to useless. It was just, and this was a matter of multiple stories in both the Pioneer Press and the Star Tribune about how they basically did next to nothing on the Fong Lee matter. So, you know.
Absolutely. All right, Mike, hey, we appreciate it again in your role of continuing to be a contributor, and we'll probably be back to you. Please do this. Keep us abreast of Ira's situation.
Sir, and I appreciate both of you gentlemen for having me on. I really enjoy it.
All right. Thank you, sir.
See you later.
All right. Yeah, Mr. Allen, wow, you know, boy, a lot of information. I repeat what I said earlier. If I were a person that was just stopping through Minnesota for some business meeting or et cetera, I would be concerned with what I've just heard as it pertains to so many Pacific incidents of misconduct, corruption, and dishonesty under a political system that has a political party that talks in terms of how liberal they are and how much they're concerned. In fact, one of the questions that I'm always puzzled by is that, you know, we don't hear anything from our congressional Representative Ellison, and let me tell you what drove this, and I think we need to certainly touch on this for the purpose of transparency. I'm fascinated. I haven't seen any press release from Congressman Ellison on the censure of the longstanding and beloved icon Charles Rangel, who was just brutally beaten. I mean, littered. I mean, by the House Ethics Panel, and the full House will vote to, I guess they did yesterday, to censure him. And, you know, it was interesting. This man asked for mercy, which I know, here's a man who was a Bronze Star winner in Korea, shot, wounded, that whole kind of thing. It must have just torn his heart apart to have had to humble himself, but he figured that maybe there would be some reflection and understanding and respect for the 40 years he's put into the Congress. And, man, there was none. And I kept looking for, here locally, some kind of press release and statement by Congressman Ellison, but maybe, you know, Congressman Ellison was okay with what happened to Congressman Rangel.
Yeah, you know, and I look for that, something like that also. And we haven't heard a lot about our local 5th Congressional District Congressman, but also it seems like there is a witch hunt going on in the black community, elected officials, especially the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation, where they actually did misuse some money. But ever since President Obama has been elected, it's some type of, I call it buyer's remorse or something. And
you have
people that, you know, are saying, okay, you guys got this, that's enough. And they're cutting off the legs of black America everywhere. And so,
good example of that is the next trial in the House, which will be that of the beloved 16-term Congresswoman, if I'm not mistaken, Maxine Waters,
yes,
of California, who, I mean, the allegations they made against her are just absolutely, I mean, she didn't have anything to do with anything. Her husband belonged to, well, her husband was on the bank. He didn't, the board of the bank that received some stimulus money, just like every major bank in America did, and they maintained that she did not give appropriate disclosure. There was testimony that it clearly happened, that she did. But they are going to bring her and require her to what is called stand in the well. And it's clear now, based on what I see happening and with this new juggernaut of conservative gangsters coming in, that she's probably going to also be censured. I found it amazing in the case of Representative Rangel how close all of a sudden people began to talk in terms of expulsion, which, you know, that is the legacy of his seat, because he holds the seat of the beloved and legendary Adam Clayton Powell Jr., who was expelled from the United States House of Representatives on three separate occasions, returned each time by his constituents. But Representative Clayton Powell recognized the fact that his constituents were being denied involvement and, more importantly, representation in the political process. And that's how ironic, and I'm understanding that there were some representatives, including Joe Wilson, the infamous white congressman from South Carolina, who hollered out in something that had never been heard of before and called President Barack Obama a liar during the State of the Union address earlier this year. And do you remember there were no sanctions? Remember that some members of the Black Caucus talked about sanctions? And even Nancy Pelosi, who's been returned as minority leader now, said, well, we don't want to do that. But yet they just destroyed Charles Rangel, and they're going to do the same thing to Maxine Waters.
Oh, yeah, most definitely.
Yeah.
So we're sitting here on a powder keg of stuff that's going on. And I know last week, Mr. Edwards, we had talked about the gentleman that was running for his life and jumped off the 394 bridge to his death.
Jason Yang.
Uh-huh. And he was kind of portrayed by the local media, who did not know him, as just, this club goer that was actually running for his life in downtown Minneapolis. And I want to know.
He maybe was a gangbanger. Go ahead, sir. I'm sorry.
Yeah. And I also want to note that on last week's show, we did not give Mr. Yang's ethnicity or anything, because we didn't have all the information. And if we did at that point, we were going to wait until all his family was notified. But
sir.
Mr. Edwards, for our listening audience locally and nationally, why don't you tell them what Mr. Yang was or what he formerly did?
Well, first of all, let me do this. So give our number again. We failed to do that. If you would, the number that we can be reached, and then I will go into the details of the death of Jason Yang.
Sure. You're listening to On Point. Our call-in number is 1-877-572-4288, broadcasting live from downtown Minneapolis in the McIntosh Studios. Again, number is 1-877-572-4288. We welcome your call. Okay,
all
Mr.
Right. The situation is that a little over a week ago now, a young man, 29 years old, according to the reports, was at a club in downtown Minneapolis. Initially, Matt McKinney and others wrote the story in such a way as to say that Mr. Yang was involved in a fight, an altercation. I noticed that disappeared from the story in this morning's edition of the Minneapolis Star Tribune, which reported on a legal action that Mr. Yang's family had to take in order to even be able to review his body. But let's go back a week. An altercation allegedly takes place at a downtown club, and allegedly, according to the police version, Mr. Yang takes off running because he was the prime participant in a altercation. He allegedly runs in what would have been a westerly direction, in other words, back towards the Target Center, allegedly jumped a barrier, then jumped a cyclone fence, and then just jumped onto the highway from two stories up, according to them, where he suffered massive internal trauma and injuries, and there he died. Okay, I mean, that was the... On this program, Mr. Allen received information via electronic communication.
Yes.
That he had actually been the victim of police misconduct, including the possibility that he was thrown by the police during the course of a series of actions out there, he was thrown to his death. Now, that area is known to me fairly well. In fact, I had seen two situations there, 2007. In fact, on one situation, I was with Sergeant Hamilton, Officer Roberts, and we were joined by current and then Fourth Precinct Inspector Mike Martin. And what happened was, within two consecutive nights, Fridays and Saturdays, for whatever reason, two individuals jumped off from that same area. Now, they did suffer compound injuries to their legs. In other words, one individual broke both legs, other individual broke his ankle. I went back after we got the information last week and after our program of last Saturday. I went back into the area, took a look at allegedly where his path would have been. It's difficult to determine how an individual would make that kind of leap without assistance. And you remember we talked last Saturday in that someone was calling to say that we had given his race as black when we did not. And so the audience knows Mr. Allen went back and listened to the recording, and, of course, we did not. But last week, what we also said, which no one is challenging, is that we said we were attempting to find out. You had already sent a communique to the Minnesota Department of Transportation. See, nobody wants to talk about that.
No.
If there could be some review of the tapes of the videos,
yes,
because there are cameras all along there,
because that's
also a speed trap, okay? We found out in the middle of this past week that those tapes, cameras allegedly were not engaged. There was no video. Sounds like the Carl Eller case, okay? But I have run into folks who are saying that Jason Yang was thrown from that location, landing really on his back, which caused the kind of injuries that took place. Now, to the question of his pedigree, if you will, as we said earlier, we were left with the impression a week ago today that, I mean, this was some young gangbanger, young Asian that was downtown acting crazy and et cetera. Mr. Yang was a couple months ago, he was a vice president at Associates Bank in St. Louis Park and had just been hired the week of his death or just a little bit before that, had just been hired as a interpreter for the St. Paul Public Schools.
Yes. Yes.
He was a degreed individual, family man, three children, which they didn't get around to reporting on that until today. And so I'm puzzled by the rumors that are now at play. Now, what happened was, on Tuesday of this week, for those of our international and domestic audience, his family, his wife, went to the medical examiner's office in downtown Minneapolis, which is right across from the Hubert H. Humphrey Metro Dome, home of the quote-unquote Vikings. They were denied access, and they were denied an opportunity to view his body. Now, in the Hmong culture, there is a very elaborate process that takes place, you know, prior to burial or internment. A very, very sensitive process that takes place. And so the family was attempting to do that. They had brought someone to talk in terms of the preparation of the body outside of what is done by Western hands, if you will. Well, on Tuesday, they were denied any opportunity to do anything, and apparently at some point in the next 24 hours, obtained the services of Attorney Jill Clark.
Mr. Edwards, we have a call on that note.
Oh, do we? Oh, okay. Well, then I'll finish. Let's get this call. Let's hear what the question is.
You're live on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, I haven't been able to listen in a while. Just been traveling the country and have called in once before and try to catch your program whenever I can. And I was just actually listening to a couple of things that you said. Usually, I am a little critical of Mr. Edwards and some of the things he says. I live in Los Angeles, so may have a little more conservative view. Now, I take issue with one thing that you said. However, I can help you on another thing that you had mentioned, another topic. First thing, I believe that if the young man was engaged in criminal activity, no way do I condone him. However he ended up on the highway, I do not condone that whatsoever. But if he is engaged in criminal activity or a fight or whatever it may be, and he decides to run, at that point, I believe he takes his life and the responsibility that he bears to stop into his own hands. Now, as it relates to the cameras, that is the industry I am in. There is no way in the world that a highway department can say that that is the only tape that they have, because you always have redundant coverage over any highway area. Not only that, there's no way that a tape can be erased, because everything is on a DVR, a digital video recorder, that will always be backed up. It's a server. So they should. There's no way that they'll say that they have an inoperable camera. That just doesn't happen because you have redundant coverage on a highway just for that fact, just for that, just in case that happens. So
let me ask this question,
yeah.
Caller, and appreciate your comments, and we understand the relevance. That's what's important about a democracy, a difference of opinion. But let me go back with you, sir. You're calling from Los Angeles. You're on the West
Correct.
Coast out there, from the
Correct.
Legendary Los Angeles, California, that is legendary with respect to police misconduct and brutality. Oh, okay, we don't want to get into that. But anyways, first of all, in the case of Mr. Yang, there is no empirical evidence or proof that he was involved in a criminal activity.
Okay.
As it pertains to his fleeing, we only have the police department's version, sir, of his fleeing. We only have their version. We don't, unfortunately, Mr. Yang is not with us. Okay.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And we are trying to ascertain if his attorney, or the family's attorney of Mrs. Jill Clark that we were talking about before you called, sir, and we appreciate your call, if Ms. Clark has been able to ascertain from the police, and this is going to be a real ticklish situation, if she has been able to acquire from the police the names of the witnesses that the police questioned on the night of the death of Mr. Yang.
Right.
Now, one of the things that I was not able to complete it, sir, and ended we have you with us, you know, kind of get your take on that, because I'm interested about the camera piece.
Right.
Initially, the Star Tribune said that he was involved in a fight and some kind of criminal activities and he was fleeing. There was no independent corroboration of that. Now, we talked to a reporter at the Star Tribune on this and another celebrated unfortunate case here. And I found it rather interesting that the Star Tribune could not produce a interview with anyone who confirmed the police version.
Right.
If you, sir, are familiar with how quotes go and how publications craft and shape how they write something, there are certain requirements of ethics, journalistic ethics, of what you do when you make a quote like that he was fleeing from a fight.
Mm-hmm.
If you're with me, sir, on that. If you go back and look at the story, it's not bracketed in such a way that this was a quote that was made from some independent citizen. It came from the police report. So let us at least hold in abeyance, sir, at this particular point in respect and remembrance for the deceased. We don't know what happened. We do know he's dead. And
right.
we do know that his body plunged almost a story and a half on his back.
Right.
Given the damage. Now, if I could, sir, what happened was that what we didn't complete with you, sir, was that it was necessary for his family to obtain a court order yesterday here in Minneapolis to allow the wife and another member of the family to actually see the body, though they were not allowed to take pictures because they have heard some things relevant to the injuries to his body. Okay.
Right.
Now, this is a violation of Minnesota law, though the medical director, Dr. Baker, is indicating that they were blindsided, caught off guard. They had been talking to the wife since last Saturday. They thought the little Asian woman understood what was going on. They were surprised. All that is a misrepresentation. Okay.
Correct.
Now, the cameras. We had been told by the Minnesota Department of Transportation that there's no video of the death of Mr. Yang. You're saying to us that there's a protocol that would bring that into dispute, sir?
Especially within a state, especially within a DOT, a Department of Transportation, because on a highway, there's so much that can go wrong. So
mm-hmm.
now what almost every city in the United States has a comprehensive video system on their highway system. I mean, say, for instance, if a truck, you know, and I want to back up and say by no way do I condone what happened to the young man. And I'll go back to another point where you can actually go because, again, in a city that is very close to the Target Center, that is very close to all of pretty much the heart of downtown, there
mm-hmm.
will be cameras that are focused on the activity of the street. So somebody saw what happened. There's a camera that you can follow that you could just go and walk around the city and look for a camera. If there's a camera there, wherever there was some activity, they have a shot of whatever happened. So now going
sir,
back to
let me say again for purposes of transparency and our listening audiences domestic and internationally, first of all, my colleague, Mr. Alan, a week ago, was on top of that. He made professional contact with DOT.
Right.
They sandbagged us. Okay. I went to the scene because, as I said before, I have that particular area has had a reputation of people going over the top, if you will. Mm-hmm. And in 07, I was present at two situations in which people fell, and they suffered injuries to their legs and et cetera. But Mr. Yang, according to sources that we have, sir, was thrown in such a way, or he fell, excuse me, sir. He
right.
fell in such a way that he fell with his back towards the ground, which is interesting, which meant that he leaped over the cyclone fence and just leaped into the air
right.
and spun and fell backwards. But the police
okay.
maintained that there was no one in close proximity to him.
Right.
But witnesses
okay.
indicate that there were a number of police that were chasing him. So I just want to, again, for transparency, want to clarify
right.
that. But,
no, I understand.
But I cut you off, sir, and I'm sorry.
No, and just saying that, you know, by no means is will the city and the Department of Transportation not have any video of that. There's
so
no
they
way
have
it's
told
happen.
Mr. Allen and myself, yeah. they're telling us they're making a misnomer, misrepresentation with respect to, they said there's no tape of anything yeah. dealing with the death of Mr. Yang.
Right. Well, and especially if it was over a bridge. I mean, you could imagine that. Say, for instance, a car had driven across the bridge, and it blew up. So the city's going to say that there's no recording of that car going over. And so now, so anyways, what you can do in closing is talk to the Department of Transportation, and they do have DVRs, a digital video recorder, where they are required by law to keep a log of everything that happens. And it's basically what it is. It's a big computer where they keep
okay.
all video.
Yeah.
All right, sir, I can't let you get away because you're calling from L.A. and we do this with our domestic international call. Earlier we were talking in terms of the future of the beloved Congresswoman Maxine Waters. I have to ask you, sir, you live in Los Angeles area. Does she still enjoy the support of her community?
She definitely does, and there's a story, if it hasn't coming out, came out already in the Los Angeles Sentinel, which is a very large
African-American
paper. Right,
oh,
exactly,
okay.
in Los Angeles. So she definitely does have the support. I mean, that's one thing that, you know, I have noticed is that she, you know, she does have the support of her constituents.
All
she
right,
definitely.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate you calling.
You're welcome.
From the Los Angeles area. Okay.
Take care of yourself.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. Wow, Mr. Allen, looks like a person right up there along with you knows that technical stuff.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's one thing. He made a really good point about the DVR because, you know, working in communications, you know that you always are security. You always have to have a backup. And
yes, sir.
I understand clearly that stuff is, like the gentleman who called from L.A. said, that is on a hard drive somewhere. And I'm asked to, you know, you try to use the chain of command, and you ask the first line first. And so first thing, actually, after we get done with the broadcast, we're going to request that we look at that again through the commissioner, Mr. Sorrell, Thomas Sorrell, and copy Bernie Arsenal on it, because I know they have that stuff on file over there.
And let us say, sir, that this is a commitment we're making here. Excuse me, on point, Mr. Allen and myself are making that commitment. Mr. Allen has already made that request, and yet nothing has come up. This last caller, I don't know, interesting questions. I know he's absolutely right, and like I said, we'll have to go down maybe with your camera equipment and photograph where all the cameras are where Mr. Yang fell to his death.
Yes, exactly.
You know what I'm saying? Right. Okay, well, interesting, L.A., okay. Just want to make note, I had to ask, I can appreciate the statement that they don't necessarily agree with some of the things that we say. That's what this is all about. But I appreciate the fact that he indicated that Congresswoman Maxine Waters continues to enjoy the support of her constituents. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, that's wonderful. Speaking of very proud and prominent African-American person. On this date in 1866, Howard University was established by General Oliver O. Howard in 1886. That's a little piece of information from the African-American Registry. I decided to sign up for that. And it's a great site because it will shoot you an email off every day of some exciting and interesting and informative pieces of African-American history. And I just decided that, you know, I might as well do it all year long than wait till January or February and sign up.
And by the way, I you know, as a 71-year-old African-American, I don't accept the fact that we are to be allowed January and February, in some cases 1 month, to talk about our history. I talk about it and respect it and love it 365 days a year. Appreciate your comments on that one, Mr. Allen.
Yeah, and I said that to get into the to a little segue piece here. We want to get into the sports piece that you were talking about earlier, if I'm correct.
Big Sunday allegedly coming up for a team that we say here at On Point has missed the playoff opportunities. Vikings and Green Bay Packers will be going at it tomorrow, which will probably be the last game in which Brett Favre will be going against his former team, which will he will wear their colors, by the way. Nobody ever talks about it. He will wear the colors of the Green Bay Packers when he goes into Canton, Ohio, the Football Hall of Fame. I mean, there's no doubt about it. But big game tomorrow. Everybody's still talking in terms of what is called a pipe dream, that the Vikings will still have enough in the tank, whatever that means, to make the playoffs. I doubt it, particularly in light of the kind of playing that Lovie is getting out of his Chicago Bears. They defeated a Thursday night football game, rare Thursday night game, defeated Miami 16-0 in Miami. Shutouts are rare in the National Football League, though there have been a couple in the last couple of weeks. Jets got shut out a couple of weeks ago. But anyways, a lot of discussion. We'll see a lot of consternation and frustration if the Vikings don't defeat Green Bay here tomorrow, Mr. Allen. We'll have a lot of discussion on Point this time next week. The other thing is congratulations, though I don't know how they'll do, though I'm thinking that they're going to win tomorrow. Minnesota Gophers under the legendary Tubby Smith, who, interestingly enough, also continues to come under criticism from the white press corps here. I call them the Joseph Goebbels press corps. You know, they were very hard on Tubby last year, even though, you know, Tubby had a team that he had to really kind of match together and put together. He won his 16th consecutive year of 20 victories. That's just basically unprecedented. Only the great man, John Wooden, exceeded that. But the Gophers win in Puerto Rico, in San Juan, Puerto Rico, yesterday, last night, beating 8th-ranked North Carolina, if you will, and they will play West Virginia tomorrow, 6:30 Central Standard Time. But I just want to send out a shout-out, if you will. Is that what they say on the hip-hop programs? Send out a shout-out to Buddy Smith and his Minnesota Gophers. And particularly, I know how proud of Father Ralph Sampson III, really playing some top-notch ball for the Minnesota Gophers. I'm looking for the Gophers to break into the top 25, particularly if they beat West Virginia tomorrow, and possibly the top 15. And so this is all positive for Tubby Smith, who continues to be criticized by the by the white press corps here in Minnesota.
Yes. And did you get a chance to see the Timberwolves at Los Angeles Lakers game last night?
I saw some parts of it. I participate in a bowling league, you know, to keep one functional and active. I was really concentrating more on my bowling game, watched it on TV. I did see the Vikings. I was at the Timberwolf game Wednesday and saw them play that other Los Angeles team, the Clippers.
Okay.
And they have potential. Last year, for the first time since the franchise was here, I didn't go to a single game. I mean, I watched them on TV. I mean, they were that bad, okay? I really don't – I'm not necessarily a Kurt Rambis fan, and I noticed the white media here does not criticize his coaching, by the way, and they only won 15 games last year. But they've got a lot of talent, Mr. Allen. They're a young team. They're very athletic. Athleticism is – which is an interesting word that's used quite a bit now by the – by the media, particularly the white media in this country. But the Timberwolves have a lot of athleticism, if you will. Michael Beasley seems to have his head right now in the right place. I think he got in the loss to the Lakers, he got 25 last night. Kevin Love, unfortunately, who did something that hadn't been done since 1982, a week ago,
30 and 30 as pertains to scoring points and rebounds. He got 31 points, 31 rebounds. He didn't have a good game last night, and I think the Timber Puppies, I call them the Timber Puppies, were really looking forward to probably a little bit more of a stellar game from Kevin Love. But this is a team that, now let's say, asked me the question in January. Okay, Mr. Allen, late January, asked me the question where I think they're at. This team has got the potential, the Timberwolves have got the potential to create some problems. I don't know if they can make the playoffs.
Okay.
Because the West is tough. It's a tough conference. I mean, they've got some heck of a team, starting with Los Angeles, Golden State, Phoenix. San Antonio, by the way, 10-1. You know, they said Duncan was all through in San Antonio. Obviously, they didn't know what they were talking about. But this could be a Timberwolves team that could get the fans back in the stands. Now, they had a sellout last night, but the only way you get a sellout in Minnesota now with the Timberwolves is if somebody like Los Angeles and Miami. Now, Miami won't be here until next to the last home game in April. So, but anyways, you hope for the best. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. So they're going to be hand-to-mouth until Miami gets here, because I know that probably be a sellout also.
Oh, it will be a sellout. It's already a sellout.
Oh,
it's
wow.
Already a sellout. Yeah.
I'm going to have to squeeze in down there. One thing I'd like to drop in there, Mr. Harris, is a little bit about this. There's a group that either they're meeting now or they just got done meeting about North High School, about how to get 125 students in the North High School for next year, freshmen.
But isn't that the job of the Board of Education?
Well,
and
I think
the school district, isn't that what your tax dollars and your tax levies go to? I mean, what's their job? I mean, I've been hearing this and I've been seeing it on websites and et cetera, and I'm like, yeah, okay, fine. In fact, there was an article in our paper, this Minnesota Sports Recorder, saying the district is now pointing a finger. If I was a cartoonist, I would have drawn a picture of Bernadette Johnson pointing a finger at the black community, saying, you know, it's your responsibility to go out and find 125 black students, or excuse me, I'm sorry, 125 students, and et cetera. But here's the thing I'm a little puzzled by. The community said they're going to go out there and do it, and et cetera. And so what's their marketing scheme? Because the North High alumni group has about $100,000 stashed away. So they're going to spend some of that money?
Yeah, you know, and that's what I'm trying to find out. I'm going to prepare some information to send out just, you know, for news coverage and just to get a better understanding, because there's two gentlemen in charge of the North High Alumni Association, and one of the young men, I went to school, high school actually, with his father, and I know that he is doing the best that he can do with that, what he has to work with there, but every time that, you know, I sat in one of these meetings about 2 weeks ago, I spent about, you know, no longer than 15, 20 minutes there, but my deal is they're not looking at the whole picture as far as the marketing, the public relations, getting out on the streets, boots on the streets, and getting that grassroots engagement going, and then they get hit by another study that was published actually in the New York Times by the Council of the Great City Schools that now says, again, proficiency of black students is found to be far lower than expected. Okay? And it was released Tuesday in the New York Times. But, you know, here in Minneapolis, Sergeant Spiel's not going to pick this up. You're not going to hear about this important one of the graphics I use is called Schooling for the New Slavery. You know,
well, now I'm a little puzzled because we just brought in a new education staff reporter, a gentleman by the name of Corey Mitchell. Though I saw Corey Mitchell in this morning's edition of the paper writing some crime stories. Apparently, they needed a black face to go out and deal with the crime reporting they do, because the other two black reporters at the Star Tribune work on sports. Wait a minute, I'm trying to get a feel here. How come Corey Mitchell hasn't picked up on this?
Well, he should have picked up on it because this was a national release, a national story in the New York Times. Even with these points, it says, you know, only 12% of black fourth grade boys are proficient in reading compared to 38% of white boys. And only 12% of black eighth grade boys are proficient in reading compared with 44% of white boys, okay? And so that's a huge gap there. And if Mr. Mitchell is doing the education beat, you know, he should have picked up on this. There should have been a follow-up locally here based on us having one of the worst disparity gaps in education for people of color in the country.
Absolutely.
So
Well, the initial question that you asked was the 125 students that the community is supposed to go out and recruit, and
yeah.
if they come up with 125 by, I think it's March 31st,
yes.
that they will, they, the community, will be rewarded with a new version of a new North High School with a limit of 500 students. Now, this will be in competition, though, with the new Noble Academies, which will be coming in here from Chicago. Is that correct?
Well, that's what we hear, but there's some shaky ground going on there. Reports are coming in actually to both of us, Mr. Edwards, that the money may not be there. So.
Well, I'm told again by people who are in the arena of education that the district has fudged. I'll use that word. The district has. I won't use the word reneged, but the district has fudged on its monetary commitment to Noble to come here, and Noble has said until the district is able to come forward with the seed money that the district promised, that Noble has no intention. Now, what does that do, by the way, for Noble's board of directors? Because that has been a well-kept secret that Mr. Allen, my associate here, uncovered a couple weeks ago. Do you have the list, Mr.
Yeah,
Allen?
I was just pulling it off. You caught me there.
Okay.
Here, let me get.
Well,
that.
I'll just continue to you get it up because this board of directors of the Noble Charter Schools had been kept extremely secretive until Mr. Allen, under color of law, while I like to use that word here on the program, under color of law, went to the State Department of Education, who provided him with the list of the directors, and with the exception of the daughter of the publisher of Insight, who, you know, I guess this was a part of their being rewarded for going down to Chicago in May and again in October and signing off on Noble, I guess she got a chance to be on Noble's board. And do we have the actual stipend that is going to be paid to the Noble Board of Directors if it ever gets off the ground?
No, I don't have that information yet. But like you had said, you know, I had made a request at some very high levels just to get the initial names. And a couple other folks, you know, people that I've never emailed before in my life have sent me other information, which I'm actually compiling for a very, you know, on-point story. But the list we have here is Batala McFarland, who is the daughter of Mr. Al McFarland, publisher of Insight and editor of Insight News, the weekly newspaper that is in the rack.
Conservative black paper.
What's that?
Conservative black paper.
Conservative black paper, yes. Very
yes,
much.
Conservative, yeah.
And then we have Russell Mosley. No idea mm-hmm. who that is. Susan Dotterly.
Okay.
Rick Champion, Campion, C-A-M-P-I-O-N, however you like to pronounce that.
Okay.
Rosetta Balch, that's okay. For those of you that wanted to Google their name, that's Rosetta, B-A-L-C-H. Chancy
okay.
Anderson is the sixth person there, and also Phyllis Saltzman.
Okay, okay. And this is the board of directors. The chancellors, if you will, the board directors of the new Noble Academies, which will be coming into North and South Minneapolis, allegedly,
if
the
yes,
district,
sir.
The district comes up with the seed money that initially had been promised to Noble's administrative staff and their board in Chicago. Okay, so again, back to the 125 and to the North High School Alumni Association. Now they. They have a little over 100,000. Have they been filing? Are they required to file a 990?
Well, it depends on if they are a single entity, IRS nonprofit 501c3, and they've been granted that status, or if they're under the Minneapolis Public Schools 501c3, where the school district would be their fiduciary agent.
That's
kind of the gray area that we're trying to figure out. And, I mean, I'm asking the right questions, but when you have a lot of emotional people, as, you know, granted North High closing or is or allegedly getting ready to close or talking about it, it creates a lot of emotion. And if you come from them to them on a position of accountability, they feel that you're attacking them.
And yes.
Everything's cut off. When the point is, okay, you need to get 125 students. There's over 1,500 students within a 5-mile radius of North High, okay?
Including 100 of them live across the street.
100 of them live right across.
They can't go to North. Right, go ahead.
So what are you going to do? I mean, how much money have you spent at this point putting together all this stuff with this PJAM group and this and the flyers? Is there some accountability for that? Let's look at this picture, because in business, you look at the money first before you move forward, okay? Rather than the emotion and move backwards and then find out, oh, you done gave out money to everyone, you don't have nothing to do anything, and the school district can just come in and snatch everything from under your legs. So,
okay.
It's very interesting.
Go ahead.
Yeah, it's very interesting to kind of pick at this and find out what position they're in. You know, what is the ongoing concern of the North High alumni association?
Well, let's do this, Mr. Allen. Let's be on point here right now that we're going to attempt this coming week. Well, it's going to be a short week because we have Thanksgiving coming up. That we're going to try to do everything we can to get Stan Allen, the spokesperson for the Special School District Number 1, to come on the air with us next Saturday and kind of clarify some of this, particularly the situation with the 125 students, the situation with the future of Noble Academy. And also, we would be remiss because there was a very interesting meeting earlier this week at City View, which is the K through 8 school that is to also be closed, that Ms. Johnson forgot to mention until a parent confronted her about it about a month ago. Quite a emotional meeting at City View as African-American parents were demanding of the superintendent to explain the rationale, the logic, and everything else about the closing of City View. Now, City View is being offered as a site for another academy, which would come into North Minneapolis, which makes me wonder what kind of commitment Superintendent Johnson has to the future of public education.
Yeah, okay, Mr. Edwards, just in the matter of time that we were talking about the board members' names, an unidentified source has mailed me the proposal for the Minneapolis College Preparatory School. And I'm looking at it here. Of course, the MCP Board of Directors, as I said, Anderson, Balch, Cambion, another new name, Kevin Kator, Susan Dowderly, and Russell Mosley, and the planning team, Joni Peterson, Pablo Sierra, Diana Ristoff, Michael Casera, and Garland Johnson. And I'm just looking down through that. The primary contact person here is Russell Mosley. I have all his information. Mailing address, Mr. Edwards. Get this.
Okay. Yeah.
Monticello, Minnesota.
Yeah, because he's the chairman of the board. That's the name we've been looking for the last month. He resides in Monticello, Minnesota. I mean, a lot of black folk up in Monticello, right? By the way, Monticello is the home base of the All-American Boys, which are a prime group operating with neo-Nazi factions in the metro area, particularly the northern Stearns County and up through there. That's the gentleman we're looking for, Monticello, Minnesota. Sure. He's the chairman of the board.
Yes, he is. Yes, he is. we have him.
I tell you. By the way, on that particular note, we certainly want to, because there's so much discussion about job creations now. There was another meeting at UROC earlier in the week, Wednesday, talking in terms of the future of light rail. Republicans say they got something else in mind. But we also need to find out what the plan is for job creations, because everybody's now talking about, ever since the Republicans won in a national sweep and a state sweep, everybody's been talking about, on the Democratic side, about job creations, okay? Same Democrats that said we couldn't talk about job creations.
Exactly.
So maybe we also can get an offer by email/telegram. Maybe we can get State Representative Bobby Joe Champion to walk with us and give us a better understanding of the jobs creations and where that $8 million is from Living Cities.
Yeah, they're not really being too forthcoming on any of that. And you know, Mr. Edwards, we've been going to these meetings now on the light rail and other things that have come and gone through the community for quite a few years. And you don't, when you bring up where are the jobs to this DFL infrastructure, you know, that's not what they want to talk about. But now, like you said, now the Republicans have taken over state capital here in Minnesota. Now the Democrats are hopping on the jobs talking point, okay, to get that attention and kind of position it that, you know, like the Star and Tribune had a article in the paper I think it was this week. Just let me double check here. Earlier this week, or maybe early last week, and it had that the Republicans are here to, you know, change.
No, I think you're talking about this past Monday, front page.
Yeah, yeah. GOP.
Above the fold. Yes. Yeah. I'm looking at it here on this computer. Yeah. The Republicans said we've got some different ideas, and also the Republicans are saying we're going to take a look at the building of a new facility for the Vikings.
Yeah.
And which that could create tremendous job creation, particularly in light of where they're actually talking about building it, and we've discussed that on some other programs that we are involved with. But you've got that article now? You've called it up?
Okay. The article that the Star Tribune posted was GOP victories could derail Minnesota transit plan.
Yeah.
And after talking to a couple of GOP operatives that are in the tight circles, they were able to give me enough information to come back with the story that the Minnesota Republicans seek to stop wasteful spending on light rail and focus on jobs and the DFL noncompliance.
Uh-huh.
Which means that the elected new Republicans coming into the state capitol are saying that, hey, okay, we have a problem with MnDOT. We have a problem with these construction jobs. We have a problem with both cities as far as their civil rights and compliance in contracting compliance for people of color and women. So we need to focus in and take a look on that because there's money being spent. It's being wasted because it's just now the disparity report that was released on the
21st. The what report now? What report?
The 2010 disparity report showed that people of color are not. There's no funding streams for jobs. I mean, for people that have companies, contractors, painters, graphic designers, professional services, commercial recorders, there's not a funding stream at all whatsoever to bring people of color up to that fair playing field.
Well, not only that, the disparities study, and we would invite people to go to our websites, National Research Institute's website, as well as our website, Through My Eyes, as well as your websites, and to our column in this week's edition of the Spokesman Recorder, and then we will have part two in next week's edition of the Spokesman Recorder, in which we have, you know, really, as a team, have blown up the fact that much of the information over the last 10 years that has been produced by the Civil Rights Department and by extension the City of Minneapolis to the federal government and others is in fact bogus. It's smoke. It's a total misrepresentation. The report, and I'll do this, it's called The Recommendations. It was the second part that was filed the day after the main report. It's at page 17. The disparities report / recommendations. What has basically happened is that the information is clear and concise, and that is that we have nothing but misinformation and fraud has been committed. Black folk do not get the jobs. They don't get the contracts, misrepresentations, and also the document names who some of those are that have been involved in helping this criminal act. And that's really what it is, Mr. Allen.
Yeah.
It is a sad commentary. But folks need to, if they can, get their hands on the disparity report because Velma Corvell and the council have cut a deal. They will finalize and move on the proposed actions and close the report down on December 9th.
Yeah.
She allegedly is taking public comment. But the only way that you can get your hands on the disparity study is that you must either get it on the city's website, and there's some control going on there, or you can come to the Civil Rights Department, make an appointment. You'll probably get an appointment after December 9th, which will be too late. But people really, here in Minnesota, particularly Minneapolis, really need to review that disparity study because the and by the way, the city paid $500,000 of taxpayers' monies to have themselves exposed. I don't think they expected the report to say what it said, Mr. Allen,
mm-hmm.
but when you talk about the macabre, if you will, the
yeah.
city paid $500,000 to expose itself.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was really interesting because, you know, the Minneapolis Department of Civil Rights, Ms. Corbell said, yeah, just call us and come on down, make an appointment. I'm going to tell you, Mr. Edwards, you talk to anybody that's called the Minneapolis Department of Civil Rights, you do not get a human ever on that phone line. Okay? Ever.
No. And also, if you actually go to the facility, and you have, in fact, you took a camera crew there,
mm-hmm.
and, in fact, have shown on YouTube and on other websites the sign on the door, which indicates that the public cannot come into the facility other than on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And this is the Civil Rights Department of the City of Minneapolis, and you must do it by appointment.
Exactly.
Now, we have sent in some individuals, if you will, and 75% of the time, even after you ring the bell, no one comes to the front desk. And when they do come to the front desk, they indicate that there are no investigators there or there is no one there on that particular day to take your complaint.
Yeah.
We sent two African-American women in. We will not name the date because we don't want city attorney and them to be able to figure it out and go back and check the cameras because we've got a specific group. We sent two African-American women in there this week. They came in, they rang the bell. I mean, it's not funny because they had legitimate concerns, but they had come to us expressing those concerns. They came in, they rang the bell. Somebody came to the front desk and told them there was no one there to take their complaint. They should come back after Thanksgiving.
Yeah. Oh, after
Thanksgiving. Now, the purpose, the reason that they had come is that about 7 months ago or thereabouts, they had filed a complaint, and they were waiting, had been waiting for almost 6.5 months for an investigator to get back to them on that particular situation. And so they had come to the Civil Rights Department earlier this week to ascertain the status of their complaint,
mm-hmm.
and we're told that there was no one there to answer that question. Come back, as I said before, come back after Thanksgiving.
Wow.
So you're absolutely, sir, on point. You're absolutely on point with respect to what's happening there. The other thing that has, the deal has been cut, there was a series of meetings over the last 20 days in which Ms. Corvell has put in place the team who will be a part of the cover-up, including her own role with respect to the school district's administration building at 1200 West Broadway. You know, we haven't read the roster of the committee that was put together in the last couple of weeks. She's a part of it. The head of the St. Paul Human Resources / Civil Rights is a part of it, Bishop Howell. Craig Taylor and others, you know, people are asking us not to talk about it, saying that we're insensitive, we're trying to divide the African-American community. And I said, how do you divide a community with information that's factual and these folks are operating off of? I'm confused, Mr. Allen.
Yeah, man, I'm definitely confused because they're working on the down low. It's really funny because when these people get in public, they talk about, oh, yeah, we're here for full transparency. We want people to know everything that we're doing. We want to be intentional. But, okay, being intentional, first of all, these folks, you're not Barack Obama, President Obama, okay, who actually has his people put everything up on a website where you can track every nickel of what's going on. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
These folks here, they go, okay, well, we don't have to do that. We don't have to tell you. And I'm going to tell you that, Mr. Evers, this week I've seen a couple of kind of covert community meetings with people that don't really have a voice except for that particular circle.
Okay.
But the problem is that particular circle, the people in that circle work with organizations that can guide some money because there is this group of funders that come together in North Minneapolis, the POLADS, McKnight Foundation, Minneapolis Foundation, there's 6, 7, maybe 12 that they meet once or twice a month, you know, if that, to talk about where they should guide their funding, what
Absolutely.
Money they should put it out, who should get it.
Mm-hmm.
So on the top of that list is the Northside Achievement Zone / Peace Foundation, who I say couldn't find the word peace in a Beatles song, sit there, and they've been the golden child. But yet there are other little nonprofits right now that are really sneaking up on them and doing some really great things because, you know, they lost the, Community Promises, I think it is, grant. I might be wrong.
Yep. Neighborhood.
Mm. Neighborhood Promises grant,
mm-hmm.
which went to McKnight. But, you know, they're still trying to whittle their way. And Councilmember Samuel's wife, Sandra Samuels, who's the chief executive officer over there at NAS and the Peace Foundation, who said that, you know, that's unfortunate. She said this actually at a dessert with Don outing, Don Samuels, her husband, meeting, and said, stood up and said, well, even if I have to resign, okay, well, how are you going to have to resign if you told everybody you're not making no money? You know, you're a volunteer. But on fact,
but that's not what their 990 shows.
No, that's not what a 990 shows. Definite salary there.
That's right.
And
in excess of $60,000+.
Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm,
exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you can tell that to some of the people, but, you know, we're all of us. You can't talk to everybody like they got tails. Okay, because some of us will go back on the computer and look at this stuff and see your misrepresentation through the community about what you're doing.
Absolutely. I mean, this is what it's been like. Though I am hearing that the Republicans are now saying privately that as soon as they take control, though they do not control the Attorney General's office here in the state of Minnesota nor the federal, that they intend to possibly use their powers as chairs of the committees to begin to raise some real serious questions, particularly in light of the diversity study that Mr. Allen and I just talked about, that they intend to ask the Minneapolis, what they call the Minneapolis Legislative Delegation, for some explanations about this report. As we said before, this report was not done by a bunch of colored guys or colored women. Okay, this report was done by one of the most prestigious research entities and advisors to the federal government and white corporate America in the world.
Yeah,
they did the report. Well, you know, we're coming down, Mr. Allen, to like about the last 3 minutes. Anything in addition we need to be moving on?
Yeah, no, I'm done with that, but we do have a few announcements we want to
go right out. Ahead. Go right ahead, sir.
Yeah, and I just want our listeners to know that the Miss Black Minnesota USA pageant, you know, it's been in mothballs for a while, and it's coming back from the ashes, and it's on December 4th at Ted Mann Concert Hall, and it's going to be a nice event. They're going to have Kenny Lattimore, Kid Capri is going to be at the after party at Ohm. So this is an event for a segment of our listenership and the population of the Twin Cities to go ahead and get your tickets, $25 to $40. Be a VIP, get a $50 ticket, you know, and enjoy yourself. On another note, the National Association of Minority Contractors are having their annual awards and dinner gala coming up here on December 4th also. Both of these events are the same night. They're two separate, two separate crowds, okay? So we can support each of them. You know, some of you go other way, some of you go this way. That's going to be on the 4th, and that's going to be downtown at the Millennium Hotel on Nicollet Mall. And we also, I think we have about 2 minutes left here, actually 1 minute left here. We'd like to wish everybody a happy Thanksgiving, happy holidays, and be safe, and come back with us next Saturday at 4 o'clock and On Point. Mr. Edwards, anything else?
Just to remind folks, because we are culturally sensitive, that not everyone celebrates Thanksgiving, and particularly my Native American friends say they see no reason to have an appreciation and thank Thanksgiving, if you will. And I can understand that, and so I think it's only fair that we let people know that. But anyways, the best to you and your family, Mr. Allen, and the best to our many, many, many listeners on the West, East Coast, and across the world.
All right. Yep. Thank you. You've been listening to today's episode of On Point with Don Allen and Ron Edwards. We'll be back next Saturday at 4 p.m. Thanksgiving. That's all I'll say.